integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation.
Today, Army Judge Colonel Christopher T. Frederickson convened an Article 39A arraignment hearing December 22nd on Fort Bragg in the versus Sergeant Robert B. Bergdahl. The military judge discussed the rights held by the accused, inquired on the record regarding current military counsel and civilian counsel. Sergeant Bergdahl indicated he was satisfied with his defense counsel. The judge explained Sergeant Bergdahl's right to be tried before a panel or a military judge. The judge also inquired if Sergeant Bergdahl wished to enter any motions or a plea at this time. Sergeant Bergdahl deferred all of these decisions to a later hearing. Colonel Frederickson also announced that Army Judge Colonel Jeffrey R. Nance has been detailed for all further judicial hearings in this case, and the date for the next scheduled hearing will be January 12, 2016, here on Fort Bragg. This concludes our statement. Thank you.
Sergeant Bo Bergdahl made his first appearance in military court on Tuesday, facing two charges: desertion, which is punishable by up to 5 years in prison, and the more rare misbehavior before the enemy, which could earn him a life sentence. Misbehavior before the enemy is defined as a soldier who runs away, shamefully abandons their unit, endangers the unit's safety, engages in cowardly conduct, and fails to do the utmost to capture or destroy enemy troops. Bergdahl was captured by the Taliban in 2009 after he left his army post. He was released after 5 years in captivity in a controversial prisoner swap in exchange for five Taliban soldiers from Guantanamo Bay. Bergdahl has maintained that he abandoned his post in order to alert superior officers to unsafe practices in his unit. Prosecutors argued that Bergdahl put the lives of his fellow soldiers at risk as they frantically searched the Afghan countryside for him.
Welcome back to Military Justice. Thanks for joining us again this week. Today, we are very fortunate to have Dan Lamoth, a reporter for the Washington Post, come on to discuss the Bo Bergdahl case. The Bergdahl case is set to go to trial in late October of 2017. So we're just going to get right into it. Here's my interview with Dan, and then I have some saved rounds and alibis at the end of that interview. Again, thanks for listening. Today, we are joined by Dan Lamoth. Dan, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Glad to do it.
I know you've been really busy with other reporting, especially about the hurricane in Puerto Rico. So I really appreciate you taking some time. So you're at the Washington Post right now, correct?
Yes. Yes, I am.
And do you cover just military affairs?
I would say 95% of it. I've been doing a lot of Coast Guard recently, so I guess that's outside the Pentagon, but still military.
Oh, listeners, please don't get me going down that road. Coasties, we love you. You are part of the military, even though you have a different budget line.
So, yes, indeed.
So, Dan, how did you get to the Washington Post? What did you do before that?
I'm on my third job covering the military, and I've been in D.C. about 10 years. Previously, I was at Foreign Policy Magazine for about one, and then prior to that, I was just short of 6 years at Marine Corps Times.
And then what, about 3 years now at the Post?
Yeah, it was 3 years in the spring.
When did you start covering the Bergdahl case?
At the Post, primarily. I think I may have done a story or two when I was at Foreign Policy, but really I picked it up big time at the Post. I covered the Article 32 in person in Texas. And have really stayed with the case, I would say, closely since my first year at the Post in 2014.
Oh, so you go back to, what was that, September of 15 for the Article 32 hearing?
I do.
Where are we? Where are we in the trial right now?
Well, we've got a trial date set the week of October 20th. There's still some question, I suppose, of whether or not that will happen, but it's starting to look more and more likely that is indeed going to be the start of the trial. We have been moving through motions hearings for months now. Really, I may even be closer to saying years now. And, they pop up about once a month, and there's the media coverage of those have dropped off, in part because it's some of it's just been process. They're working their way through things like, when do you get clearances? Who gets the clearances to look at the documents and when? And I think it's going to surprise a lot of people who haven't been following right along when all of a sudden this explodes back into the news when the trial starts.
Right. And so if I'm correct, I believe we have one more possible motions hearing on 17 October.
That's right. Yeah.
So at this point, and feel free to jump in at any time, as far as recent decisions that you've mentioned, there have been a lot of procedural ones. And right now, Bo Bergdahl has decided to go judge alone. So there will not be a jury. The judge will decide guilt, and if found guilty, will decide punishment.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a judgment call where they're looking at it saying getting a fair decision in their eyes is probably going to be harder from a jury trial. So if they'll throw themselves at the mercy of the judge if convicted, and then I think the question that a lot of people have had from the start it's way less about whether or not they convict him of something like desertion. It's way more about what the sentence actually becomes.
Yeah, because an underlying current of all of this has been an almost an admission by the defense of the UA or AWOL, and then really about when it stopped. And I believe the judge at one point said that you are free to plea to the lesser included offense that is AWOL terminated by apprehension. That it just happened to be apprehension by the enemy. But the government can still go forward on both the desertion and misbehavior before the enemy charges.
Right. And if you go back to the Article 32, at this point, 2 years ago, that was an argument that they made in court back then. Basically, he acknowledges the unauthorized absence going UA for a period of a day or so. His plan was to get back to the base, so he was going to turn himself in then. In his eyes, therefore, that the plan was never to go UA more than a day. And obviously, with him getting captured the way he did, in their eyes, the UA period ended then.
That's not an uncommon thing. When I prosecuted, I did a lot of UA cases when I was a young trial counsel. But usually you had a termination, or the UA that was terminated by apprehension was usually by state police. Somebody got picked up on, for a DUI or something. During that time, it's not possible for them to turn themselves in because they are in the hands of authorities. This just has the difference that it's the Haqqani network.
Yeah, that sounds, I would imagine that argument, some flavor of that argument's definitely going to come up. The other pieces to this are going to be, is he in any way responsible for injuries as opposed to just the threat of injuries? And I think we've seen some of that hashed out in testimony in these motions hearings without a lot of finality to it. So all of this is going to come up again.
Yeah, give us a flavor of what that testimony was like when I believe that the judge is going to allow testimony from two individuals who were injured, or at least the prosecution's arguing that they were injured while searching for Bo. What was that testimony like?
So I was not in court for that testimony. That took place at Fort Bragg over the last year or so. But yes, that's focused much more on whether or not he is responsible for the wounding, gunshot wounds, of these individuals who are on operations in this very stressful period of time in which pretty much everything they did included is Bergdahl here. Some of these operations were specifically focused on looking for him. Some of these operations had other purposes, and they were looking for him besides. And sorting through that has been difficult, especially because a lot of the documents remain classified.
Oh, yeah. That's the portion that I think is one of the most difficult for the government, is producing all those documents, because those are, I mean, the people, the equipment, you know, the way we're designing all of our actions, those are all highly classified. And so very difficult probably to get all of that to the defense. I think that's been one of the largest impediments to getting the court-martial done earlier.
Yeah, I mean, there was long arguments over, you know, in what format Gene Fidel, his main civilian counsel, would be able to look at some of this, what it would take to clear him, where he would be able to look at it, and that has dragged out for months.
Yeah, and physically, that's just, usually they're going to be held in a skiff, which is, that's just a, I mean, you can have big skiffs that are as big as buildings, or you could have a skiff that is just a room where there's either a computer terminal or hard copies of documents that the defense could actually look at. Military Justice is brought to you by the good people of ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to go to post your jobs to find the best candidates? Well, it's ZipRecruiter. In fact, just this past week, I was at a party talking to a longtime family friend and business owner, and I mentioned that I was just getting sponsored by ZipRecruiter, and she said that she used it and got great candidates through it. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus sites in one click. Then the powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anybody else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of the jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get qualified candidates in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, the listeners of Military Justice can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/military. That's ZipRecruiter.com/military. One more time, to get it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/military. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. It allows this podcast to continue. So let's say the judge has already made a ruling, correct me if I'm wrong, about there were no deaths, or the government has conceded there was no deaths resulting from looking for Bergdahl?
So the general at the Article 32 testified that it was his assessment that there were no deaths directly from it, that certainly people had been put in danger. But Colonel Nance, the individual who it looks like will be trying this case, he left it a little more open. I think especially as some of this testimony has come up more recently over, you know, whether or not, I don't think we have a clear read on whether or not at trial that's such an open and shut case.
Oh, okay. So there's been some indications that the government will still go forward on a theory that there were injuries and additionally deaths as while people were looking for Bergdahl.
I'm very much waiting to see what they're going to allow and what they're not going to allow at trial.
Right. And then I guess that the Article 32 officer, the three-star general, then becomes a defense witness. He wasn't the Article 32 investigator, but he was the general originally put in charge of this investigation, that he's already opined that there were none.
Theoretically, that would make sense. I don't have a read on that, but that theoretically would make sense.
Have you got any witness lists? Have any of those been posted, or have you come across those in your reporting?
I haven't come across them. In terms of the specifics of who's testified, it's people that were in the region and at the time, obviously. So, I mean, we're talking a mix of some special operations and certainly the army units that had, you know, kind of control of that part of eastern Afghanistan at the time.
The judge has also ruled that none of Bergdahl's statements come in. So none of the, I think there were at least a half dozen videos that he made while in custody. None of those will come in the trial, correct?
Yeah, and that becomes interesting because, you know, on one hand, you've got him in his own words. In the other, it was obviously a very complicated, stressful captivity. And I think there's some assessment of, at least some acknowledgement that, you know, what he said at that time may not be a true reflection of what happened.
Right. That I guess the government couldn't prove the voluntary nature of those statements, that they could be coercive and therefore not reliable.
Right. And I think the defense really from the very beginning has tried to present in as many ways as possible evidence and really just, you know, hey, here it is, some sense for what he was going through, the specifics of the torture, the specifics of the captivity, you know, and where that left him as an individual. I think we're all – the other thing that is going to be key here, I would think, is the diagnosis and acknowledgement of a mental illness. And how did that play a factor here, both in the decision that he made to leave the base in the first place and where he is in life now?
Right. And when the military was first aware of that mental illness, did that only come through the Army or during his short stint in the Coast Guard?
Right. And I mean, it emerged. It's a schizotypal personality disorder, which the research would show you is basically you have these periodic breaks of sorts where you're not necessarily seeing things per se, but you know there's some sense for you're not sort of in your right mind at a given time, often with stress introduced. And it appears that that's what they're going to probably argue in part when you get to the specifics of the case, that he made this decision at a time under duress and wasn't really seeing the world clearly.
Right, because he just, during different times, isn't, I don't know if we would say unable to, or it is difficult for him to accurately assess the world.
Yes, yes, very much so.
We've also had a number of, I think we're going back a little bit in this motions hearing, but we had the motion from the defense to dismiss for unlawful command influence, and that's all stemming from, I guess, candidate Trump's statements. Numerous statements, I think, about Bergdahl during the campaign, calling him, I think, a traitor, that he should be hung, a number of things. What happened with that motion?
That was thrown out, and that was something that Eugene Vidal, again Bergdahl's main lawyer, very clearly took umbrage with that, and that was one of the greatest hits for Trump on the campaign trail. I mean, it was something that came up many, many times, and Fidel literally tracked those to the best of his ability down to every single occasion, every single location, and shared those both with media and with, you know, in their appeal on that, and really just tried to get at the specifics of how much he thought that tainted where this would go next.
Yeah, I've seen that. I'll include that in the show notes. You can see the video compilation, and I think it's, if I remember, it's about 40 minutes of the video compilation of candidate Trump talking about Bergdahl.
Yeah, and that was something they put together, I think, both for the sense of trying to get it out to the public and then also trying to make their case to the Army.
And that hasn't ended President Trump being brought up in this case. I believe there was also a motion during voir dire, so the questioning of potential jury members. This would obviously have been before the decision to go judge alone, but potential jury members, they wanted to ask if they had voted, the defense wanted to ask if they had voted for President Trump, right?
Yeah, that was another thing they were getting a sense at. And I think they're trying to weed out, you know, people that they don't think will be favorable to their case, obviously.
Right.
But, you know, when you start going that route, it does get complicated.
So as it stands right now, we're still going forward with, or the government's going forward with desertion and misbehavior before the enemy. Are you going to be physical? Obviously, you don't always know this because of breaking news, but do you plan on being in the courtroom for the trial?
The plan tentatively would be to definitely cover the outset in person down at Fort Bragg. Probably spend several days there up front, opening statements, all of some of that sort of flavor of stuff. And then I think media organizations in general are going to have to wrestle what to do with this if this drags out for weeks, if not longer. You know, in our case, you know, yeah, like how long do you put a specific reporter against only one story?
Yeah, just to, and this is just more of the mechanics of it. So when you're reporting on this, are you actually in the courtroom or do they have a separate closed circuit area? What's it like for your reporting pool? Because I kind of imagine there's quite a few of you trying to get in.
Yeah, I'm actually interested in that myself. The way it worked during the Article 32 was that there were a handful of seats for reporters and then a very large overflow room that had probably something on the order of 30 of us in it. You know, everything from the Serial podcast folks to regular, you know, Associated Press wire reporters and people like me. And the Bragg courtroom isn't very large either. So while they have been able to get the majority of us or all of us in to the hearings that we have attended, I know I've attended one or two of the ones down there, especially early on in the motions process. They had maybe a dozen seats or so. Hypothetically, even if it's just the same crowd that we had during the Article 32, I mean, there's going to be 30, 40, you know, that won't fit.
Yeah, and just for the listeners, I haven't been in Bragg's courtroom, but I can speak for most of the Marine Corps and Navy courtrooms. They're not big buildings. These are not, you know, what you would imagine in like a large federal district court or something. They're, you know, maybe 6-8 rows of seating, maybe seating for 20 people. I would say probably the average Marine Corps courtroom is like that. Is that what's Bragg like?
My frame of reference is having covered cases at Quantico and covering Bragg. Bragg is larger than Quantico.
Okay.
But it's still smaller than, you know, like a federal courtroom would be. For example, I mean, having covered civilian cases, you know, a lot of those rooms, you're looking at 8, 10, 12, 15 rows of seats. Bragg's was probably closer on the order of like 4 or 6, one row on each side, aisle up the middle.
And I imagine you'll also be tweeting about this, right?
I would anticipate that we may or may not be able to take our phones into the courtroom. That certainly has come up in the past. You know, oftentimes it's no electronics at all. You know, covering the Article 32, it was legal sheets of paper and pad and pen as fast as you could write.
Right. But then you probably drop some of those once you get out of court, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, very much it would be like, okay, those are sort of the classic, you know, covering a trial, covering proceedings sort of situation where you're like, all right, I have half an hour to maybe grab a half a sandwich, file something, tweet something, and you know, you've got to balance that time how you and your editor see best.
Speaking of, where can the listeners follow you on Twitter? I'll also put this in the show notes, but what's your Twitter handle?
Twitter handle is Dan Lamothe. That's DanLamothe.
And you're one of those blue people, huh? You're super verified.
Yeah, that sort of just appeared one day. I love to say it's because I'm so witty and charming, but quite honestly, that was something the company took care of.
No. Did you have it before you were at the Washington Post?
I believe Foreign Policy did it.
Oh, okay. Well, what else can you tell us about the Bo Bergdahl case?
Well, one interesting piece here is they did seek a pardon from the Obama administration, and Obama's people decided to just not act on it before leaving office. You know, I think some people were surprised by that, but there was never a sense closer to the case that was any kind of done deal or open and shut, despite him commuting sentences for Chelsea Manning, for example. Like, I think this case, there was acknowledgement that they needed to proceed with some sort of legal proceeding and at least let the process take care of itself.
Yeah, I've talked to some colleagues that have worked on those type of clemency requests or pardons, and there's just such huge numbers of those also. And that especially when a two-term president is leaving, you know, everybody tries to, hey, get one before the president. So we'll be following you. Is there a way that any chance that you might want to come on afterwards and tell us about this this final trial that we've all been waiting for so long?
Yeah, I think that would be very doable, particularly, I mean, quite honestly, I think when we're in the process, when you get sort of that week or two in and, you know, I've been able to get my head around where we are in the case and we put together a couple of good stories on it, you know, I think at that point we'll probably have a lot more new material to talk about.
Well, great. Dan, thank you very much for being on. I love your reporting. I guess you'll probably be getting back to more hurricane reporting. But thanks for taking time with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Saved Rounds and Alibis. This is the section of the show where I answer questions from you, the listener. First, I want to say thanks to Don K, the Navy JAG. I appreciate you listening and providing your feedback. It really helps. Now, on to the most controversial portion probably of this episode. And I'm just going to tell you at the outset to avoid too many hateful remarks. I'm making a prediction about the outcome of the Bo Bergdahl prosecution. I'm not revealing which side I'm on. This isn't what I hope will happen. This isn't what I believe should happen. This is my prediction. Think of it as an NFL pregame show where you're just making predictions about the outcome of the game. That being said, I understand that this will upset people from both sides, and I still enjoy your feedback. But try to remember, I'm trying to give you my objective view on what will occur during the Bo Bergdahl prosecution. Article 88 of the UCMJ is absence without leave. That means a member left his or her post without authority. I believe that the military judge will find Bo Bergdahl guilty of AWOL. But an AWOL for more than 3 days, but less than a month. And that same judge will impose the maximum punishment, which in that case is 1 month of confinement and forfeiture of 2/3 pay for 1 month. Likely thereafter, there will be an administrative separation of Bergdahl, although that's something that we can definitely get into after the prosecution. But for the record, I'm saying that Bo Bergdahl will be found guilty of Article 88, absent without leave, and given the maximum punishment for that short-term UA, which is 1 month of confinement, and forfeitures of 2/3 pay for 1 month. This second question has been asked by a number of listeners, and thank you for going mostly to Twitter and submitting these questions. A lot of people have asked about the transgender memo finally issued by the White House. And I think this is where we are right now, or this is where we are right now. No new recruits who are transgender or who identify as transgender. I think that will probably be upheld. The office of the president has quite a bit of authority in that arena. So I think that will be upheld. As far as gender reassignment surgery, as of 23 March of 2018, no funds may be used for gender reassignment surgery. Those members currently serving, the Secretary of Defense is required to report by 1 January of 18, and no actions can be taken until that time. So the Secretary of Defense needs to make a report to the President what should happen with transgender individuals who are currently serving. I don't really have a definitive answer on what that will be, but I will keep you updated, and we will see what the Secretary of Defense comes out with. I would predict that it probably wouldn't be the separation of all transgender individuals. That's wrought with a number of problems because they voluntarily came forward with that information. And then Senator McCain came out and made a statement and said that all of this was a wrong move by the president. So that's the update on transgender service members, and I'll keep you updated as we get those reports. The third question was submitted by Chris K. Thank you, Chris. You asked, can the accused in the military invoke the right to remain silent during an Article 32 or in a court-martial? Short answer, yes. The military accused can do that. So at the Article 32, again, that is the preliminary investigation and would look similar to a court proceeding, but you would have usually a lawyer in almost all the branches, make a recommendation to the convening authority about what charges should go forward and which shouldn't. Witnesses will be put on, and that report will finally go to the convening authority to make a determination on how to proceed in the case. Of course, a court-martial looks like a civilian trial, and in both of these instances, the military accused has the right to remain silent. To give a little background on the rights of counsel and rights to remain silent. In this arena, the military has actually been more forward-looking and more protective of service members than you would have in the civilian courts. So looking at the law governing this, you have the Fifth Amendment, which says no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. You have the Sixth Amendment, that is, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to have assistance of counsel for his defense. Those come from the Bill of Rights. In 1950, you have Congress pass Article 31 of the UCMJ that says no person subject to this chapter, I mean subject to the UCMJ, may compel any person to incriminate himself or to answer any question, the answer to which may tend to incriminate him. You'll notice that Article 31 doesn't explicitly contain the right to counsel, but that has been incorporated through case law coming from the Sixth Amendment. So the Miranda rights, as you've all seen many times in televisions and movies, that is, you know, given by the police officer to the accused. Miranda is decided in 1966. The Fifth Amendment requires that officer to give the following rights, or to make the accused aware of the following. One, the right to remain silent. Two, to be informed that any statement made may be used against him. And three, the right to the presence of a lawyer. For the most part, Miranda revolves around issues of custody. Was the person in custody when they were questioned? Were they free to go? We look at an objective test. You know, was there a formal arrest? And to tell you the truth, this would be a probably 10 episode answer if you got into all the details of Miranda and all the exceptions to Miranda. But generally speaking, it's the objective test if someone was in custody at the time they were questioned. The Sixth Amendment, of course, is the right to assistance of counsel. And this is where Article 31 differs a bit. These are the three things that are required in the Article 31 warning. One, the nature of the accusations. The service member must be made aware generally of what he or she is suspected of. Two, made aware of the right to remain silent. And three, that a statement may be used against him or her in a criminal proceeding. A lot of Article 31B litigation is focused on who must warn, who requires. So that's usually looking at the position of authority and the or a person subject to the chapter. And it recognizes the subtle pressure that is inherent in the military. The reason it differs generally from the civilian view is anyone being questioned in the military, if you're being talked to by a superior, you answer questions. That's, I mean, really the essence of the military is being forthcoming and doing what your superiors request of you. So in light of that, Congress recognized this and the courts have further recognized that there is an inherent amount of authority and control with any service member being questioned by any superior service member. Currently, again, this could take a number of podcasts to go all, you know, through the development of Article 31. But right now, the general test is, was the person asking these questions in an official capacity? Was it a sergeant questioning a PFC or a lieutenant colonel questioning a first lieutenant? Were they acting in their official capacity? This isn't just conversation. And two, the second part of the test is, was this more than a casual conversation? Was the senior looking in his official capacity to question a subordinate about? And to be clear, this doesn't have to be a senior subordinate situation. That's just the illustrative point I'm using. So it's got to be the person acting in an official capacity, and two, more than a casual conversation. So Chris K, thank you for sending this question. I hope I answered your questions, but generally speaking, the military accused has more rights in the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent arena than his civilian counterpart. Thank you all for listening again. At the end of this, I play you a few minutes from the compilation of statements by President Trump. It's far too lengthy to put everything in the podcast, but I will put a link to that video if you'd like to see that in the show notes. And I hope you enjoy the show. Thank you, as always, for your support, and I'll see you next time. Wyrick out.
Talk to me a little bit about, you think that the White House wants this whole thing to simply go away and that there's not going to be any court-martial or any of the things that we talked about before?
Well, they just want to save face. It's an embarrassment. I don't think they even knew when they were negotiating. You know, these are great negotiators, right? I look at this 5-to-1 trade. We have a traitor and we have 5 killers that are looking to destroy this country. And that's the kind of a trade we make for a traitor. In back pay, and he was a traitor. And we trade 5 killers for 1 traitor, and now we're going to give the traitor $350,000.
We get Bergdahl. We get a traitor. We get a no-good traitor.
And we get a traitor named Sergeant Bergdahl trying to get this traitor.
And yet we save a Sergeant Bergdahl who's a traitor, a no-good traitor. But we fought to get a traitor. We have Sergeant Bergdahl, a traitor. Right.
So we negotiate for Sergeant Bergdahl, a no good traitor. We get Bergdahl, a no good traitor. Sergeant Bergdahl. We get Bergdahl, a traitor, a no good traitor. Sergeant Bergdahl. We get a traitor named Sergeant Bergdahl.
Person's captured. They're a hero as far as I'm concerned. Unless they're a traitor like Bergdahl. He was captured. He's no hero.
This is like Sergeant Bergdahl. We get a traitor. And no good, rotten traitor like Bergdahl.
You look at Sergeant Bergdahl. We get Bergdahl, a traitor.
So we get a traitor named Bergdahl. A dirty, rotten traitor. So we get Bergdahl, a traitor.
That's sort of like Sergeant Bergdahl. Has anybody heard of Sergeant Bergdahl? The traitor. No, the traitor. We get Sergeant Bergdahl, a traitor. Sergeant Bergdahl, right? We know Sergeant Bergdahl. A traitor. So we get Bergdahl a traitor. We get Bergdahl a traitor that we don't want. So we get a traitor named Bergdahl.
We're tired of Sergeant Bergdahl, who's a traitor. He's a traitor, a no good traitor. With Bergdahl, who was a traitor, it was treason.
We get Bergdahl a rotten traitor.
Sergeant Bergdahl, a traitor, a traitor. Think of him. He's a dirty, rotten traitor.
Traitor Bergdahl, and we get Bergdahl a traitor. Sergeant Bergdahl, we get Bergdahl a dirty, rotten traitor.
Sergeant Bergdahl, a traitor.
So we get Bergdahl a traitor, and we knew he was a traitor.
Sergeant Bergdahl, the worst, the worst. He's a traitor, he's a dirty, rotten traitor. A horrible traitor who deserted.
And they knew he left, and he was a traitor. For one dirty, rotten traitor.
I always bring up Bergdahl. We get a traitor, and we get a dirty, rotten traitor.
Military Justice is a production of Long Arc Digital Media. There are numerous people that need to be thanked for making Military Justice possible. First of all, audio. Those are the people that clean up all the mistakes I made. Hannah McCarthy, she takes care of that. Methil Talhan, she takes care of everything. And as always, Uber producer Dreadnought has my six.